program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Today we'll begin with Greenland's Jens Frederik Nielsen is Belle of the Ball. This was written by Vivian Salama. The coffee corner at the Hotel Bayerschriefhof in Munich is so mobbed with diplomats and executives exchanging business cards and guzzling caffeine that it's easy to miss even the most recognizable faces. And Jens Frederik Nielsen is not one of those. Still, the baby-faced Prime Minister of Greenland was surrounded by throngs of people looking to shake his hand, pass him their card, or take a selfie with him at the annual Munich Security Conference, the first major get-together of European defense and security officials since his country became the center of a geopolitical melee. Nielsen, who is 34 years old, assumed office less than a year ago, but has spent much of his time facing an assault on Greenland's sovereignty by President Trump, who wants to acquire or annex the autonomous Danish territory, whether its citizens want it or not. Over the thrumming of cappuccino machines and the clinking of coffee mugs, Nielsen told me he was having none of it. "That's a red line," he said. "We will not give away territory and compromise our integrity." Greenland has been the unlikely belle of the Munich ball as U.S., European, NATO, and other leaders try to hash out just how serious Trump's threats are. Trump said he has ruled out taking Greenland by force. But given that he also earlier this year ordered a military raid without congressional approval on Venezuela to remove its president, no one here views the crisis as over, especially not Nielsen. As I spoke with the Prime Minister, the White House released a series of satirical Valentine's Day cards, among them one with the map of Greenland inside a heart. The caption reads, "It's time we define our situationship." Nielsen, with Scandinavian restraint, acknowledged that his country has faced tense periods of late. It will almost certainly face more soon. White House officials tell me the president remains fixated on Greenland and is unlikely to back down, even though there are now high-level talks underway about boosting the U.S. military presence there. At this month's annual black tie dinner at the Alfalfa Club, a Washington, D.C. society for muckety-mucks from politics and business, attendees told me that President Trump, in private conversations, reinforced his desire to buy Greenland, not invade it. When I shared that with Nielsen, he looked frustrated, but not surprised. "That is not acceptable," he said. "We will not give it away." But in terms of more military personnel, and in terms of more cooperation and so on, let's talk. Let's have a conversation about it. We can figure things out. Secretary of State Marco Rubio, who headlined the conference today, didn't mention Greenland or the Arctic in his keynote speech. He didn't mention China or Russia by name either, though Trump has claimed that their intrusion into the Arctic underpins his desire for Greenland. Instead, Rubio offered a more conciliatory tone than allies have grown used to. At last year's conference, Vice President J.D. Vance was met with stony silence after he suggested that the greatest threat looming over Europe comes not from China or Russia, but rather the internal threat within the continent. The Trump administration's rhetoric and policies towards its European allies since then have largely echoed that sentiment. Rubio drew applause from the crowd when he declared that the U.S. will always be a child of Europe. Still, he stressed the need to revitalize the alliance. "We in America have no interest in being polite and orderly caretakers of the West's managed decline," he said, describing the decline as a conscious policy choice. Revitalization to the Trump administration hinges on American dominance in the Western Hemisphere, which includes Greenland despite its historic ties to Europe. Trump's description of the dynamic blends the lingo of real estate advice with the imperatives of national security. "You defend ownership, you don't defend leases," he told reporters at the White House last month. Nielsen, who worked as a real estate agent before entering politics in 2020, sees it differently. "It's a matter of international law and sovereignty," he told me. "The son of a Danish father and a Greenlandic mother, and, as it happens, a national badminton champion," he talks about deep nationalism and pride that cannot be bought, but stressed that his citizens are open to cooperation. Since Trump first expressed interest in Greenland in 2019, the country of 55,000 has seen throngs of companies looking to invest in the island's abundant natural resources, which Nielsen welcomes as long as the approaches are coordinated with his government. Tourism has spiked. Once an economy that relied heavily on fishing, Greenland has embraced its unanticipated turn in the geopolitical spotlight by building infrastructure, including a new airport, which opened in the capital, Nuuk, in 2024. A bigger diplomatic presence also has arrived. The U.S. opened a consulate in Nuuk in 2020, its first since 1953. The European Union, Canada, and France have opened consulates since, the latter two in response to Trump's renewed threats. Nielsen said he welcomes it all and more, but added, "We want cooperation with mutual respect." Trump backed down for now on his threat to forcibly annex the country, in large part because of how poorly his plans were received domestically. A new APNORC poll found that about 7 in 10 U.S. adults disapprove of how Trump is handling the issue of Greenland. That included about half of Republicans polled. Nielsen has never met Trump, nor has he spoken with him, though Nielsen met yesterday with Rubio for a conversation that Nielsen described as constructive. "Most of the discussions about Greenland's sovereignty," Nielsen told me, "have been conducted either through direct talks with the Danish government or through NATO, a process he believes is more productive." He repeatedly emphasized the progress being made by the working group formed after the foreign ministers of Denmark and Greenland met in Washington last month with Vance and Rubio. Nielsen worries about Greenland's future being defined by anyone other than Greenland and Denmark, including by well-intentioned allies. But he was keen to offer an olive branch to Trump. "We are willing to talk also about the concerns he has about security," Nielsen said. "We want to talk." And with that, he turned to the next in line. Today's second story is "The Internet's Nihilism Crisis," written by Charlie Warzel, who is a staff writer at The Atlantic and the author of its newsletter, Galaxy Brain, about technology, media, and big ideas. "More and more, it seems, I pull to refresh a feed or open up a new browser tab and encounter something that makes me feel as if I've sustained a head injury. Recently, the culprit has often been the federal government. The Department of Homeland Security is putting out white nationalist dog whistles on X. President Trump posted a video depicting Barack and Michelle Obama as apes. The subtext of every egregious shitpost from the administration is the same. These people are in charge now, and the old rules don't matter. A great deal of what I find myself scrolling past exudes a threatening, almost anarchical aura. Just before my New Year's, my timeline offered murmurings of a live streamer who appeared to have run a person over with his cyber truck. A week later, I would come to know this man as the 20-year-old Looksmaxer, who goes by the name Clavicular. He hits his face with a hammer to strengthen his jawline and pals around with the white supremacist streamer Nick Fuentes. Last month, the men were recorded in a club with other charming manosphere personalities, such as the alleged sex trafficker Andrew Tate, enjoying Yee's song, Heil Hitler. Tate has denied the allegations against him. This was trolling, but it also sent a message. We have enough status and influence to literally get them to play the most. Like you can't even find a song on a single platform, Clavicular said on a stream after the fact. Brazen displays of status and influence are, of course, what influencers have always been about. But something different is happening with Clav, with Trump, and DHS, and with so many other non-political accounts on social media today. The reason for the tariffs is the same reason Clavicular hits his face with a hammer, Aiden Walker, an online culture researcher, told me recently. It's to get attention. It's to mobilize the base. It's to prove a point that there's no rules anymore. Social media platforms, and especially X, have loosened their grip on moderation at the same time that AI tools have allowed for the easy proliferation of slop. Never before has there been so much cynical, cruel content and trolling. When Clavicular records himself breaking his body, spouting the N-word, and reveling in anti-Semitism, he's participating in what Walker dubs nihilism by default, an ideology where the only sources of purpose or profit are the self and the social media machine. This dynamic is everywhere now. It exists in political memes and propaganda. It drives broad swaths of popular culture. A kind of post-ironic fatalism that was once endemic to seedy message boards has bled into the broader culture, changing how people communicate. Nihilism is now the lingua franca of the internet. Not so long ago, many toxic elements of the internet bubbled up on 4chan, a forum that was filled with self-consciously transgressive posts and media, including revenge porn, offensive cartoons, and lots of slurs. As Dale Barron wrote in his 2017 history of the site, 4chan defined itself by being insensitive to suffering in that way only people who have never really suffered can. That is to say, young people, mostly young men, protected by a cloak of anonymity. Barron further explored the topic in his book, It Came From Something Awful, pinpointing how trolling became a game for disaffected kids with nothing better to do than kill time online. 4chan mutated from a site called Something Awful, which launched just before the turn of the millennium. 90s nihilism endured well into the 2000s, longer than most youth cultures, Barron wrote. Like wine turned into vinegar, it could decay no further. Both culture and counterculture taught new generations to be so wary of being deceived and manipulated, it was best to hold nothing in your heart at all. By the mid-2010s, Steve Bannon, then the chairman of Breitbart News, began to see these people as a viable political constituency. The trolls weren't just telling bad jokes. Through Gamergate, they began to understand that they could attract mainstream attention, generate outrage, and mobilize like-minded people. Their preferred version of reality could be foisted onto anyone. You can activate that army, Bannon told the journalist Joshua Green in 2017. They come in through Gamergate or whatever, and then they get turned onto politics and Trump. This culture didn't care about old norms and institutions, obviously. In fact, it actively tore them down. Understanding this is essential to understanding the MAGA political project. You can see it in Doge's attempt to strip bare the federal government, for instance. But it is also key to understanding other elements of chaos in our culture. This same logic drove the meme stock movement back in 2021, when Redditors banded together to inflate GameStop's stock price and manipulate hedge funds into bad positions. One fund was forced to take a $2.75 billion bailout to survive. Today, you can feel the same thing throughout online culture. You can see it in the way that 9/11 memes have become normalized. This week, I saw an altered version of a famous image from that day. An agent whispering into President George W. Bush's ear about the attacks, captioned with the words, "Sir, a second frat leader has brutally frame-mogged clavicular." A reference I explain with deep regret to a viral clip of a jacked Arizona State University student stepping into Clav's shot on stream. The process of abstracting huge news events into memes has become much faster. In July 2024, when Trump was shot in the ear, ironic memes popped up just minutes later. One of the first ones showed a photo of him bloodied, surrounded by his security detail, with the caption, quote, "Do not get your ears pierced at Claire's," end quote. Similarly, moments after Charlie Kirk was assassinated in Utah Valley University, an eyewitness recorded and posted a TikTok video that went instantly viral. "It's your boy, Elder TikTok," he shouted. "Shots fired." Before signing off, he asked viewers to subscribe to his page. His knee-jerk reaction, to use the shooting of Kirk for content creation purposes, was a sign of what would come. Within days, memes featured Kirk's face were plastered everywhere in featuring Kirk's face were plastered everywhere in photos, onto celebrities, rap albums, the World Trade Center on 9/11, video game characters, FBI Director Kash Patel, the faces of random people. The process became known as Kirkification. Arguably, peak Kirkification came in November when people on social media discovered, quote, "We Are Charlie Kirk," quote, end quote, a song, possibly AI-generated, by the artist Spalexma. The over-the-top ballad was paired with countless AI edits and lip syncs on TikTok, Instagram, and X. One of the most popular videos featured an AI-rendered J.D. Vance belting the song to a packed concert hall. By mid-November, the song had hit number one on Spotify's viral songs chart, both in the U.S. and globally. Ironic nihilism appears also to have motivated Kirk's suspected assassin to etch a bunch of niche memes onto the casings of his bullets. In the days after Kirk's death, politicians, law enforcement, and many media outlets tried to parse the meaning of the assassin's inscriptions to find a motive, or assign blame. But there was little meaning to be found. Kirk's suspected shooter, like many other modern killers, was performing for an imagined audience. Shortly after the shooting, he allegedly texted to his partner, "The fucking messages are mostly a big meme. If I see notices bulge UWU on Fox knew, I may have a stroke. This is what I mean when I use the word nihilism to describe this phenomenon. Memes flatten any event, shrinking it down and making it indistinguishable from the rest of the slop and ephemeral content in a person's feed. And they also become their own motivation for action. The 4chan logic that turned even the most hideous news and ideas into empty entertainment pervades everything on the internet now. More proof that, LOL, nothing matters. This, of course, brings us directly to the Epstein files. On January 30th, the Department of Justice released the latest tranche. Millions of pages of searchable documents devoid of context or explanation. A constellation of screenshots spread by journalists, influencers, and random accounts. Also, ample fakery. For every genuine Elon Musk email I saw in the files, I saw another that had been fabricated to appear more damning than the originals. On X, InfoWars' Alex Jones posted an AI-generated image purporting to show New York City Mayor Zohran Mamdani and his mother hanging out with Jeffrey Epstein when Mamdani was a child. The photo was obviously fake. Mamdani's mother, the filmmaker Mira Nair, was mentioned in one email in the Epstein files, which suggested that she had attended a party at the townhouse of Ghislaine Maxwell. Like Kirk, Epstein has become an all-consuming meme across platforms. Long AI slop videos of Epstein show him as a kind of conspiracy theory Forrest Gump, influencing every bit of recent world history. In one clip, Epstein is visited in his jail cell by Charlie Kirk, who gives him a Monster energy drink, which causes him to enter a porthole to a snowy fantasy realm. In all of the renderings, Epstein is depicted as more handsome than he was in reality, a typical AI glow-up. And some edgelord types seem to have become enamored with him. I'm tired of pretending he didn't have Aura, one alt-right groper account posted on X recently. If the Epstein files were intended as an act of government transparency and accountability, then it seems that they have mostly been a failure. Extensive redactions and scattershot releases have not shed much light on the most heinous of Epstein's crimes, and the files have not resulted in any arrests or legal consequences here in the United States, nor have Epstein's victims gotten the justice they deserve. What's happened instead is even more corrosive. The public has gotten just enough of a look into Epstein's life to see that he remained influential, connected, and even seemingly respected long after becoming a sex offender. The world has gotten a glimpse of the fawning, skeezy shamelessness of his famous hangers-on, but not enough to criminally implicate them. The files have become yet another data point suggesting a deep rot inside of many American institutions. The result, again, is a pervasive nihilism, where the truth of what's being discussed matters less than the fact that it is being turned into content, the reaction to which will also become content. The memes, the trolling, the Epstein video slop are all a cultural defense mechanism amid a crisis of impunity. The files are more proof that elites of all persuasions seem plenty comfortable saying the quiet part out loud or engaging in egregious, shameless behavior, banking on a culture that has given up on demanding consequences. When faced with evidence of the worst kind of sexual deviancy and conspiracy and no consequences, who could blame a bystander for choosing to hold nothing in their heart at all? A convincing argument I've seen for the prevalence of nihilism especially politically, is that the younger generations have mostly known only political and economic dysfunction. 5 years out from the GameStop ordeal, you can see a similar dynamic shot through the economy, in cryptocurrency speculation and graft, in vapid meme coins, and an obsession with gambling and prediction markets. These elements, described as financial nihilism, are especially prevalent in younger generations, who feel that the path of predictable progress, homeownership, access to a thriving job market out of college, no longer exists. Faced with that reality, taking a gamble on Fartcoin or betting how many times Elon Musk tweets in a week can feel strangely rational, the Gen Z economic writer Kayla Scanlon wrote in the Wall Street Journal. Scanlon further argues that this kind of nihilism is an attempt to find personal agency in a system that's increasingly denied it to them. Online, young people wrap their humor in so many layers of irony that figuring out what they're talking about can seem like a wild goose chase. The posters want people to research and agonize. It only serves to drive more attention to the joke. And so you get nonsensical memes like 6-7 and brain rot as Oxford University's Word of the Year in 2024. The president of the publishing house's dictionary division justified the choice by noting, "There's a sense that we are drowning in mediocre experiences as digital lives get clogged." American politics has been a nightmare since before the youngest voters were even conscious of politics. It's a tidy explanation, but also somewhat believable, that Trump's rise was a signal to many that shamelessness is a market inefficiency in the 21st century, a superpower. That logic was adopted by opportunistic influencers and shock jocks in the initial Trump years. Our culture hasn't yet been fully subsumed by nihilism, but you can also see it everywhere in different forms. In the mass shooters who seem to care about nothing other than performing for others online. In the influencers photoshopping themselves into Epstein file photos to get likes or promote their SoundCloud account. In the overnight viral sensations who become brands and try to hawk a predatory meme coin. In the Super Bowl ads for gaming apps. In the culture of AI slop and brain rot. And in an administration that prioritizes propaganda and graft over governing. It threatens to rip us apart for good if we let it. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. We hope you've enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.